All right, so it's been a while since we've been in the Gospel of Luke, so let's just take a couple of minutes here to revamp. And remember, Luke's Gospel is unique. It's written from a Gentile perspective, not a Jewish perspective. Luke, being a physician, is very attentive not only to detail as a doctor, but also in how who Jesus was affected people. Luke is very, very into that kind of thing. We're going to see a couple examples of that here this morning as we get into the study. And Luke's emphasis is to show Jesus as the Son of Man, that God sent him here as the answer to man's problem. And the way that the Son of Man is the answer to man's problem is because not only is he the Son of Man, but he's also the Redeemer. He's the one that can fix that which we ourselves broke when we separated ourselves from God so long ago, and tragically continue oftentimes to live that way, as you know, even today. So he's the Son of Man, but he's also the Redeemer. Now, as we've moved through this, we began looking at chapter 1 there where Luke introduces the Son of Man, the Redeemer. And then there's all that time spent in preparing for him. Speaking of Zechariah, who was told that his son would be the forerunner of the coming Messiah. And then when we got over there to chapter 2, we saw that now, having preparation been completed, that now the presentation of who John was talking about has now entered the picture. And of course, we spent a lot of time looking at this over the Christmas holiday because Luke's Gospel really gives us a very clear picture of what the God of the universe entering into our realm, what that was all about. And then in chapter 3, we began the newest section, which we find ourselves in now. It really will not conclude until we get all the way over there to chapter 21. But now the proclamation of the Son and the Redeemer. And we've been going through this by looking at this concept of proclamation, and looking at different examples, as Luke gives them to us, of the authority that Jesus has as the Son of Man. That he is, though he's the Son of Man, he is something that men cannot be, because he is ultimately the Creator. And we got all the way through there, and then when we got to the last part of chapter 6 there, you can see we began to look at his authority to teach. That he didn't just share words, the words that he shared made a difference. That those that heard him, you have to come to terms with what he's saying. And you're forced to do something. You're forced to make a decision. You cannot sit and listen to truth and do nothing with it. Because it's truth, it forces you to decide what you're going to do with that truth. Now, sadly, we have been looking at those that were religious who would hear that truth and then set that truth aside. Others would flat out reject it. And then there were others that not only would they reject it, but they would rebel against it. But thank God, there were those that would respond to the truth. And that's what we've been looking at. And so we saw his authority to teach, and we saw it in his words of wonder, that his words are beyond just the words of any man, because they're words that change the heart. They did 2,000 years ago when he spoke them and Luke recorded them, and they continue to speak today. That's why getting this into the hands of those people we just saw is so significant. Because it and it alone has the power to change the heart. It's God's word, for goodness sake. So we looked at his words of wonder, and then we looked at the challenge, the words of woe to those who would resist and who would rebel and who would reject the words of truth. And then we looked at words of wisdom. Those words that promised us, and we got into the whole beatitude aspect of it, that those who respond positively to the word, these are people that are blessed. They have great contentment because they know who they are and in whom they rest. And then we looked at words of warning, and that's where we concluded before we got into our holiday break, that Jesus was saying that, listen, this is truth. So make sure that you understand that to rebel, to resist, and to reject, what this is ultimately going to cost you. And the interesting thing is, we've said so many times in the past, because we live in a world that would say, oh, this isn't the truth. We know that, right? That's why they want it out of schools and they want it out of everything else, because they would resist it. But you know what? It cannot be resisted, because as I said earlier, truth is truth. And you know what I love about truth? It doesn't care what you and I think about it. It's not interested, nor is it affected by whether we believe it or disbelieve it, we receive it or reject it. It is truth, End of story. And that's what I love about it. And that's why Jesus said, heaven and earth will pass away, but my word will never pass away. That's the cool thing about truth. So his last thing there was the words of warning. Now, when we come to the next section here, we're going to look at now his authority over sickness. A very familiar story of the centurion. Luke, being a Roman, being a Gentile, is very interested in how Jesus interacts with those who are not Jewish. It's a big part of Luke's gospel. And because it means a lot to him as a Roman, as a citizen who was not of the house of Israel. And so when he points all these things out, you get to see a side of Jesus as he interacts with these people who were not Jewish that you don't get oftentimes from the other writers of the Gospels. Now, as we begin chapter 7, remember that what we started back there with the whole concept of presentation is Luke moving us towards this incredible statement of who Jesus is, and because it comes down to this thing that we know and understand as Peter's great confession. And we all know this. In fact, this is what I shared in Africa with the guys, to where Jesus, in all three of the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where he talks about how he says to the apostles, he said, listen, who do people say that I am? Remember this. Well, you're John the Baptist. Oh, you're one of the prophets. You're this or you're that. The question that all of us have to answer. But then Jesus looks and points to them as individuals and says, but who do you say that I am? And that's the question for every human being to come to terms with. Because how you answer that will not only affect this life, but the life to come. Because that is the ultimate question. Who do you say that I am? Do you also believe I'm one of the prophets? Do you also believe that I was a great teacher and a great healer? What is it that you think? We talked about this yesterday at the men's conference, the difference, as we've shared so many times. We all love the concept of Jesus as Savior, while we ignore the fact that he's also Lord. Who do you say that I am? So in chapter 7, Luke picks up the pace and is making a beeline now as he's presenting Jesus and his authority as we get to that great question that Jesus asks there in chapter 9. And so chapter 7 here, really, even though we've been moving that direction, right here, Luke quickens the pace for us. So let's read these first few verses here, and then we'll come back and we'll take them apart as we often do. Now, when he had concluded all his sayings, that is tying us back to the Sermon on the Plain that we had just been dealing with prior to the holidays. That this time where Jesus had gathered the crowds around him, but his focal point was his apostles, those whom he specifically had chosen and therefore was going to specifically send them. And all of that teaching was directed at their way. And he chose this plain, and Matthew puts him on a mount, which at another time was teaching. That's what the difference between the Sermon on the Mount versus the Sermon on the Plain. But here, now that time of teaching has concluded. Hopefully, the apostles and the disciples, the larger group that followed Jesus, would have learned some lessons. But alas, like you and I, even hearing the master himself, they come up short. And that's okay. He understands that. That's why he continues to work with us and doesn't just sort of cast us off as having not gained anything. So now he says, now when he concluded all his sayings in the hearing of the people on the Sermon of the Mount, he entered Capernaum. And a certain centurion servant who was dear to him was sick and ready to die. And so when he heard about Jesus, he sent elders of the Jews. Did you catch that? We're going to talk about that in a minute here. He sent elders of the Jews pleading with him, that is Jesus, notice the capital H, pleading with him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they begged him earnestly, saying, listen, saying that the one for whom he should do this was deserving, for he loves our nation, and he's built us a synagogue. So we have this interesting story. I know one that we're all familiar with. I realize that. But there was much to be learned here. Now let's go back and look at verse 1 a little more clearly. Now when he concluded his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. And remember, Capernaum, if you're looking at a map, there's the Sea of Galilee, and right up on the northern shore, a little bit to the west, sits a city called Capernaum. It was a fishing village in these days, and this is where Peter and some of the other apostles were from. Peter and Andrew, for an example, and James and John, they were all from that area. In fact, it was in Capernaum where Jesus was at Peter's house when he healed Peter's mother-in-law when she was sick. This all took place in Capernaum. There was many things that Jesus did in this city. And at this point, the city seems to be in favor of not only what he's done, but of who he is. Now, we're going to see when we get to the 10th chapter, that's going to change. But at this juncture, the city of Capernaum has embraced Christ to a point because they've seen the blessings. They've seen the healings. They've seen Jesus do the restoration work. And so Capernaum becomes sort of the headquarters for Jesus as he ministers in the northern part of the country, which is where Luke has us right now in the northern ministry of Jesus. Later, he's going to go south into Judea, where, of course, Jerusalem is. That's the southern ministry, but that's going to take place later. So as he enters the city, notice a certain centurion servant who was dear to him was sick and ready to die. So clearly we understand that there was this Roman centurion who lived in the city of Capernaum. Now he had been assigned by Rome. The fact that he was a centurion meant that he had command of a minimum of 100 Roman soldiers. Sometimes they had more. But whoever this guy was, he seems to be very clearly a man of great integrity and great character. Now, there's much more to say about him, and I don't want to take the time now. But there was a specific, Luke tells us, centurion who had a servant who was dear to him. Now, that's an interesting statement. Because if you're a Roman soldier, because the word servant here literally applies to the concept of slave. And if you're a Roman, of all things, centurion, and you have a slave, the last thing you want to do is be dear to that individual because other Romans would mock you. I mean, after all, they're just a slave, man. Why would you treat him? But this guy apparently had a servant that he cared very much for, someone that was close to him. Now, we don't know who this is, whether the servant was a Jew or a Gentile. We do not know. But whoever he was, he had a special and a unique relationship with this man that held the very authority of Rome itself in his hands. Pretty significant individual, huh? I mean, this guy could literally command 100 plus troops to do whatever it was he said, all in the name of the emperor, who was Tiberius at this time. He could have done that. He had that kind of authority. And yet, he has this one person, the least likely of all, his slave, that he is very deeply concerned for. So it paints a really unique picture, and it's significant that this comes to us from Luke's gospel because this is clearly something that's out of the norm. Well, what was wrong with this guy? Well, he was sick and he was ready to die. The dude was on his deathbed, in other words. He was at the end, and this guy was so concerned about this servant, this slave that he cared about, that he does something that is completely beyond comprehension. Notice, so when he heard about Jesus, those are huge words. So let's stop and think about this. We already talked about Capernaum and all of the things that Jesus had done there with Peter's mother-in-law and all of the other sick that were brought to him. It was there that he had cast a demon out of the guy in the synagogue. And it makes you wonder whether that was the synagogue that this centurion guy built. We don't know, but probably. And so all of a sudden, there's this guy, Jesus shows up on the scene, and man, he's really kicking up dust in Capernaum, but he's doing amazing things. This centurion had heard of him. And interestingly enough, he had obviously observed the fact that this Jesus has this authority to not only heal the sick, but to cast demons out. Well, now there is some authority to control even the spiritual realm. So he's heard about Jesus. Now notice what he does. He sent elders of the Jews. Now that's a highly significant statement for Luke to make. Because this centurion comes to the Jews who most Romans despised. These people were a pain in the neck for every nation that's ever ruled them and always will be, right? They are stubborn, hard-headed, as Jesus himself called them, stiff-necked, hypocritical, and all of the other things. These are some tough people. But this guy goes not to just any Jews, but to the elders of the Jews. So notice what he's doing. He's a commander. He's heard about Jesus. And we're going to see why in a few minutes he doesn't do this himself. I mean, after all, Jesus is a Jew, so he's got to come up with a mediator. So he goes to the leaders of the Jews, and he said, listen, I've heard about this guy. I've heard and believe that he can do what he says he can do. So you know what? I need you guys to go and to bring him here to fix, to heal, whatever, my servant. Because as you guys all know, this guy's really special to me. I mean, think about that. So when he heard about Jesus, he sent elders of the Jews to Jesus. Now, that's pretty significant because he would have also known that the elders of the Jews would have been resisting Jesus. Who are you that come in here with this authority? They had all said that. So for this guy to do this is really, really significant. But you see, the interesting thing about a man like this, a person like this, he doesn't care. Because the issue is his servant. He is so concerned and interested in the state of this one that he obviously cares for very deeply, that that person's well-being is more important to him than his reputation, than anything else. And so he'll do whatever it takes. Now we know later on that what Jesus is going to say about this man's faith, but this is where it begins. And what he did more so than what he says. Because he was really stepping out onto a limb here. So he sent the elders of the Jews to Jesus. Notice, pleading with him, literally begging him. He said, I need you guys to go. And whatever it takes, bring this Jesus here to heal my servant. Whatever it takes. Beg if necessary. And that's really what the word pleading means. They went, go and beg him to come. So pleading with him to come and heal the servant. I need you to go and do this for me. Now this all sounds really good because the next thing that's going to happen is notice verse 4. And when they, who is they? That's the elders that he had sent, the elders of the Jews, to go and plead with Jesus. Notice this. And when they came to Jesus, they begged him. There's the word translated slightly differently. They begged him earnestly. Listen, you got to come and do this for this guy. You and I, we don't get along so well, but this guy is pretty special. So they begged him earnestly, saying that the one for whom he should do this was deserving. Rabbi, they would have called him. Rabbi, you need to come and do this for this guy. Because as far as Gentiles go, he's worthy. Which is interesting, their perspective of him, because we're going to see in a few minutes, his perspective of himself was quite the opposite. He didn't think he was worthy at all. But they did, saying that the one whom he should do this for was deserving. Well, how did they sum up whether or not this Gentile leader of the army that was occupying their land, how was it that this guy was deserving of this? Well, he loves our nation, which is a good thing. But notice the next part, and has built us a synagogue. So here was a guy not only with some authority, but with some means. This was no local commander of a military unit. This guy was pretty significant in the eyes of the people. And so they go to him. And of course, they plead the guy's case. He's really deserving. He's worthy, master, rabbi. So you need to come and do this. I mean, the reality of it is this guy really does love our nation. He really cares for us. In fact, he's built us a synagogue. Now, we don't know this. This is a Rick thing, take it or leave it. But I wonder if there was a hint, the very synagogue, Jesus, that you were in. Remember that synagogue? This is the dude that built it. So this is kind of serious. You should probably come. I mean, after all, what if he takes the synagogue back? Right? That's always our fear, right? Oh, my, what if he withdraws his offerings and his tithes? Everything's going to collapse, right? As if God is dependent upon our tithes and offerings. Isn't that amazing? But that's, I mean, I don't know, but that's a possibility. And I love this. Verse 6, then Jesus went with him. I almost forgot to click again. Then Jesus went with them. No questions asked. Now, does Jesus know what's going on here? Of course he does. Of course. He knows precisely what's taking place. He was not taken surprised by anything, even what we're going to see here in a few minutes. So then Jesus went with them. Now, notice what is taking place now. And when he, that is Jesus, with the elders and, of course, the apostles and the disciples, and when he was already not far from the house, in other words, they were getting very close, the centurion changes his mind. And we don't know why. What we do know is that it appears that the desperation that he was feeling in his servant was so great that he initially sent word through these leaders to bring this Jesus back. And while they're on their way to do this, all of a sudden he's starting to stop and think, wait a second. I just asked a guy who has authority over the spiritual realm to come into my house. A guy who I have seen as well as heard what he has done with the sick and the blind. I have seen this. I don't know if I should bring him into my house. I mean, I've got stuff on the walls he probably shouldn't see. I got a set of DVDs that I'm going to have to hide if he shows up, right? Have to clear out that cupboard. Yeah, who knows why? But clearly there's a change of heart. Because the reality is setting in. This guy that has the authority and the right and the ability to do all these things is coming to my house, and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, I'm not sure about this. So when Jesus was near, then the centurion, notice now who he sends, friends. He sent the leaders, the Jewish leaders, to come and get Jesus and bring him back. And now he's like, oh man, I don't know. What have I done? What was I thinking? You know what, you guys, now he calls his buddies. Listen, you got to go out there and stop him. We don't want him coming in here, because if he's who he claims to be, we don't want him, you know, being a part of who we are. We're not worthy. And we're going to see that he says that. So he sends his friends, and this is what he says. And again, notice the mediation. He's not doing this himself. And he says, Lord, do not trouble yourself. Now, I read some commentators, and they said, well, really here he's saying, sir, because he wouldn't really have understood the concept of Jesus as Lord, this Roman centurion, to which I say, bunky, stinking, hunky. Yes, he did, which is exactly why he freaked out when he found out he was on his way. He knew exactly who he was. He wasn't just a sir. He knew that who Jesus was, at least it was becoming clear to him. So Lord, just as it says, Lord, do not trouble yourself. For I am, now here's his estimation of himself, not worthy. I don't want you coming in, because if you see me for who I really am, you're going to know, and maybe you won't do what it is I need you to do. Who knows? We don't know what's going on, but this is really interesting. Because the guy's perspective of himself is completely different of the religious. He's deserving. He said, I'm not deserving. You shouldn't come here. This is not a place for you. It's not going to be good for your reputation if you show up at my house. So I'm not worthy that you should enter under my roof. That's an interesting statement. And then he goes on and he says, therefore, in that case, I know I sent the Jews to you. And I know that you were coming and on your way, but in spite of that, I do not even think myself worthy to come to you. You don't need to come here, Lord. I'm not worthy. You don't need to be here. And in fact, it's probably best if I don't come to you either, because of who I am. I'm not worthy of that. You ever thought that? That the Lord of all, the Lord of truth and light and life and all of the other things that he is, ever felt unworthy of encountering him because of our unfaithfulness, our unworthiness? Yeah. If you haven't, I have. Yeah, you do. It's like, Lord, I want to say, like, this guy, listen, I know who you are. I know what you can do. But you also know who I am and what I can do. It's probably best you keep your distance. And I won't even come to you because I'm not worthy to do so. Been there, done that, huh? Therefore, I did not even think myself worthy to come to you, But listen, just say the word. Just say the word, and my servant will be healed. Holy cow. This guy gets it. He understands. He's heard what Jesus has done, and he knows that what it is about is what Jesus says that makes things happen. So I can't come to you because I'm not worthy, and you shouldn't come to me for the same reason. But you know what? Don't let that stop you for my servant's sake. Just say it, and it's going to happen. 4 and verse 8, and we all know this, for I also am a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me. And as I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. Now, was this the same servant that was now on death's bed? We don't know. But whatever it is, this guy understands. And especially if he was a benevolent commander, which it appears that he is. It's no wonder people snapped when he asked things. These are the people you're willing to serve, right? We don't know. But he says, listen, all you have to do is exercise the authority that I know you have, even if you're not here. Because what you say will be done. And I can take that to the bank. I may be unworthy, but I believe that to be true. And then, of course, we know the story. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled. He marveled. He was blown away that this guy has this kind of faith. And he turned around and he said to the crowd. Now, what's interesting about this is it says he turned around to the crowd, but it appears that he didn't just only turn around and say this, but he turned around and actually made his way, because there's no record that the two ever met, which is an interesting concept. There was no face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball encounter between the centurion with this incredible faith and the Lord of faith. There's no account of that. But what we do know is that Jesus used this opportunity to say to those who were following him, this is what I mean when I talk about faith. Says to the crowd that followed him, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not in even in Israel. In other words, I've never seen this amongst the Jews who should have known. Never seen anything like this in this world. And again, we don't know what happened, but it appears that they never met. But we do know verse 10. And those who were sent, both the friends now and the elders, they returned to the house. They found the servant who had been sick. Literally, they found him in good health. Now, it's not recorded for us what Jesus said or did, but obviously, he responded to this kind of faith. Isn't it interesting that the Lord, when we recognize who he is in spite of who we are, and exercise the kind of faith in him, that he responds? And in this case, it's significant. Now, many of us have experienced that. We know what this is talking about. Sometimes we've been frustrated because we've done the same thing and he hasn't responded. At least we think. The reality is he hasn't responded in the way we think he should respond. But he always responds to what we ask. Always, without fail. The thing is, we think he's not listening because it didn't happen the way that we asked him to make it happen. And of course, now we're moving into the realm of, well, then who's Lord? You know? Well, Lord, I want you to do this, and I have faith, and I know you can do this, but here's how it has to be done. And the Lord says, yeah, I will do that because I am the Lord of faith, but you know what? We're not going to go your direction. We're going to go this direction. And we perceive that as an unanswered prayer or a lack of faith or whatever the case may be. The reality of it is, he's Lord and we're not. And we need to get used to that. Now, what's interesting about this is the next occurrence that we come to, because not only is he his authority over sickness, but look at his authority over death. Now notice what's happened. He's done this. He's gone in here. This has happened. He's shown this great thing for this centurion. And isn't it cool? I believe with all my heart, based on what we just saw here, that this guy is in heaven as we speak. Now, I've shared this with you many times. One of the things I'm going to do when I get there is I'm going to run around. I'm going to find these guys. And I want to say, dude, tell me about that. That is awesome. What was that like? I can't wait to talk to these kinds of people. I just can't. The no names, we have no idea who they are, and yet there was this significant thing. How cool, you know, people say, well, what are we going to do for eternity up there? I'm going to be talking a lot. Gee, imagine that. I want to find out what this was like, man. That must have been stunning for this dude. You know, we don't know, but this guy, man, he had this faith. Can you imagine when it happened just as he asked the Lord to do? Don't tell me this guy didn't become a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ, please. He already was. May not have understood it, but he already was. But it's significant because Jesus had turned and said to the crowd, and now Jesus makes a different direction. Well, where's he headed? Now look at verse 11. Now it happened that the very next day, the day after, that he went to a city called Nain. The city Nain means lovely or delight. And many of his disciples went with him and a large crowd. I mean, after all, everybody's following him. Look what this guy does. Holy cow. So now he's leaving out of Capernaum, having done this, and he's walking along the shores of the Sea of Galilee on the west side, and he's going down about 25 miles to this place called Nain. So he's turned from this guy's house. He simply spoke, and it happened. So now he's turning, and he's going someplace else. And look at what happens. And when he came near the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out. Well, who's this dead man? The only son of his mother, and she was a widow. Now get this in your mind. Jesus has done this in Capernaum. He's now on his way down. And as he gets there, just outside the city of Nain, he would have crossed through another city that was called Endor. Does that ring a bell? We'll talk about it here in a second. So he crosses through Endor, and he's now headed towards the city. And as he is entering the city with his crowd as the Lord of life, he runs, makes a head-on collision with the procession of a funeral. The procession of those who have no life comes head-on with the procession of those that do. Think about that. One coming out of the city, the other coming into the city. It just so happened. Yeah, right. So when he came near the city gate, behold, a dead man was being carried out. And of course, and this guy, this was obviously, was probably in his teens. He was the only son of his mother. She had no other sons. We don't know whether she had daughters or not, but this was her son. But she had also lost her husband. Now, why is that significant? Because in those days, the sons had to take care of the mother. Well, they didn't have to, but they did. So what we're being told here, Luke is telling us, is this woman has lost everything. She has no hope. She has no future. Her husband, her provider, is no longer around. And now the son that had taken the father's place or her husband's place, he's done too. And she was a widow, and a large crowd from the city was with her. The procession of death. The procession of no hope, of no future, of no confidence is coming out. But of course, we know what's going to happen. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her. She's weeping. She what is she supposed to do now? I mean, she's stuck. She has no one else to turn to. That's the way it was. Still is that way in many countries. These women are left, you know, to fend for themselves. But when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her, and he says to her, do not weep. Now, she doesn't know who he is, at least yet. So he says this, and it's like, I mean, I don't know that this happened, but can't you just imagine her looking at him and saying, that's easy for you to say. I've just lost everything. I have no future. We don't know. But he said, do not weep. And then verse 14, and then he came and touched the open coffin. The procession of death meets the procession of life, and the Lord of both comes to the symbol of death, and he touches the coffin, and it's open, so the dude's in there. You get the idea, right? Imagine if these poor guys were carrying a coffin with Mike Easter around. I meant carcass, sorry. But you get, you know, they're carrying me out. This is the thing, and I'm late. And so Jesus says, listen, don't weep. And he comes up to this thing, and he And he comes up and he touches it. Now what that means is that he stopped the procession. So these poor guys are holding this thing up, this dead guy's in there. Then he came and he touched the open coffin, and those who carried him stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." Isn't it amazing how the Lord always comes to where the dead are? And he reaches out and he always speaks, because it's his word that heals. And it's interesting to me that in the three encounters that we have of Jesus restoring life, remember, he's not resurrecting these people. Well, Jesus would be the first resurrection when he resurrected this guy here. He didn't resurrect him. He restored him to life. It was a restoration, not a resurrection. Same with Lazarus. Same with Jairus' daughter. Those folks died again. They weren't resurrected. They were restored. Resurrection means to die and be brought back to life, never to die again. That's not what these people had. They weren't resurrected. They were restored. So Jesus says, "Young man, I say to you, rise." Notice how he speaks, always speaks to those who, from our perspective, are dead, and yet they always seem to hear. Isn't it amazing? These people were writing him off. They were carrying him to put him in the ground. He can't hear anybody. And then Jesus says, "Listen, young man, I say to you, arise." And I love verse 15. "So when he who was dead sat up, he began to speak." Now picture this. You're carrying me, I'm laying in there. Jesus comes up and he says, "Yo, big dude, rise." And all of a sudden you're the guy holding this thing and I sit up. It makes me wonder how they didn't drop this thing and kill the guy from that point on. I mean, talk about freaking out. It's like, whoa. And he begins to speak. We don't know what he said. Yeah. Good point. That was good. I didn't even think of that. "Please put me down slowly." I don't know. But he began to speak. Now, we don't know what he said, but what if he just said, "You know what? I heard you call me. I heard you." Who knows? And then the Lord takes him and he takes the guy out of the coffin and he presents him to the mother. And notice how Jesus does that. He always brings life back to that which is dead. And then he gives them the task, because this guy understands now that he's back, because he's got to take care of his mother and he's going to have to represent the Lord from this point on. Three times we see Jesus do this, restoring life to those that are dead. Once to Jairus' daughter, the nobleman's daughter. Remember when Jesus came to the house, she had just passed away, a young girl. "Talitha kum, I say to you, little girl, rise." And then, of course, now this guy, it's been a couple of days, they're carrying him out to put him in the ground. And then, of course, we know the story of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, where Jesus goes to the tomb. And Martha says, "Lord, please don't open that thing. This guy's going to reek. He's been in there 4 days." So what's the point of all of that? Don't invite Jesus to a funeral. He'll ruin all your plans. Because when he speaks, people listen, whether they're dead or not. Because he's the Lord of life. And so he has that authority. And he presented him to his mother. Verse 16, "Then fear came upon them all." You think? Could you imagine this? "And they glorified God, saying, a great prophet has risen among us." Ah, dang. They didn't get it, did they, the crowds? But I can assure you, the man in the coffin did. Ah, he's just one of the great prophets. "And God has visited his people. And the report about him went throughout all Judea." Now notice, this is up in north in Galilee. So now the report of what's happened has gone down to Jerusalem, to headquarters. But then there were also those disciples that went to not Jerusalem proper, but that returned to John and reported to him all of the things that they had seen. They were confused. They didn't understand. They had seen this. They know John had said, he's the Lamb of God. But they didn't get it. So there's all of this stuff that's going on. Again, you see where this is headed? Who do you people say that I am? Oh, he's a great prophet. Whose God is visiting us through this prophet. He's all of these other things. Remember, this is pointing us. We saw the faith with the centurion and now the raising of this young fella in the coffin. Because in either instance, he is Lord of all. And by him, all things exist. Whether life or death, principalities or powers, he is the Lord. And in these two instances, Luke has taken us with a major step towards having to come to terms with who he is. Because folks, he still, 2,000 years later, is doing this. We've seen him do it in the midst of Calvary Chapel Mesquite. We've seen him do it in Africa. We've seen him do it in Belize and in Thailand and Nepal, all of the places he has us engaged in, where those who we would think would be dead from a spiritual perspective, and the Master speaks and life is restored. Or in the cases where life is not necessarily needed to be restored, he speaks and well-being is restored. But either way, he speaks because he is the Lord. May we be faithful as this servant was to say, Lord, this isn't about me. It's about my friend. It's about my family member. It's about whatever, fill in the blank. And I know that you can and will heal. And then trust in him to get it done. And I have these family members that from a spiritual perspective are every bit as dead as this kid these folks carried out a name that day. But there was an encounter with you, Lord, as the Lord of life. So may we bear those that are dead and carry them to the Master. Because he and he alone has not only the authority or ability, but the willingness to restore life. That's the God that we serve. Amen? All right, God bless you guys. Let's stand and we'll close in a word of prayer. Don't forget.